and External Readers. I'm Catherine Druckmann. Joining us today, as usual, is Doc Searles, our editor-in-chief, and we have a very special guest today. We're kind of changing things up a little bit. We have Dana Vetter, who is actually our director of ad sales here at Linux Journal. So we wanted to talk a little bit more about the challenges that publishers are facing, the challenges that we as consumers are facing, navigating the internet that is now completely dominated and controlled by ad dollars and ad technology. And so we thought we would bring her into the conversation since she's actually very much a part of it. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you, Doc.
So where do you want to start? There are so many topics.
So yeah, so the big thing is really just the fact that so we talk about, I hate to bring this up, but I'm going to do it anyway. We talk about our age sometimes, you know, in our meetings at Linux Journal and you know, in other contexts, we talk about the fact that we've been around for a while, right? We had our 25th anniversary issue this year. It's something that comes up, and part of that conversation is being nostalgic, I think, about the web that used to exist, and I might argue no longer does. I mean, and it probably disappeared pretty quickly, right? As soon as people figured out that this was a great advertising medium, people started developing really great tools for tracking every single eyeball and every single click and every consumer behavior that you could possibly track, and now it's become something where we, as Linux Journal editors, salespeople, nerds, feel like we have to constantly battle. We have then developed tools to combat all of this surveillance, and we have, as Linux Journal, chosen not to participate in a lot of it, which I think Doc could elaborate on. But I think a big part of the conversation is what we had actually talked about earlier, and that is how difficult it is to be a pioneer. So, you know, here we are trying to change the world. And I don't know, Doc, maybe you could talk about really how we're trying to change it and then the challenges that we face doing it.
Well, first, I'd like to say, I don't know, we're doing this in video also. And so I don't know.
We are. We may or may not use it.
How you get it to move from your face to my face to Dana's face and how all that works, because I think we're stuck on you. That's not a bad thing. It's just that there it is. Anyway.
It's funny, though, Doc, when you're talking, now you're totally on my screen, and Catherine's a little person, so it's...
Oh, we did that. I didn't turn into the big person for a minute there, but anyway, okay. It's just part of how this is. So, and both of you are much better to look at than I am, I should say. So, having been in radio, I used to say that, you know, it's an old joke in radio that I have a good face for radio. So, as you can tell, if you're looking at me, I've been young for a very long time and longer than anybody else around here, probably. And I don't think things changed overnight. I think that they changed gradually. And I think that the larger picture is that we're moving into a much more digital world. Everything that can be digitized is being digitized, and we're learning the hard way the good and the bad of that. I remember, and it's in an old Linux Journal story somewhere, when I was invited down to Google when Google was in one little building on what's now their campus, to meet with their advertising team, which is a bunch of Linux geeks, and there were four geeks in cubicles in a room that had come up with the way that they did advertising in the first place, which was which became AdWords and was nothing but search advertising. And that, by the way, is still 65% of how they make their money. And they don't need spying on you in order to do search advertising. If you search for the height of Mount Everest, you're going to get ads for vacations in Nepal, you know, or whatever, whether or not that's what you're looking for. But the ads are in the old days, they were text-based. They were on the right side of the page. They didn't dominate the page. There was a little auction model they had for which ones moved up and down. There was a little usage model. But all of it was algorithmic in a way that didn't involve any spying on people at all. In her book, Surveillance Capitalism, Shoshana Zuboff does an amazing job of giving the history of what happened after that, which is they basically discovered, wait a minute, if we spy on people, we have this data surplus. We have all this data that we could use in lots of different ways, and we can use it to better target our advertising. with no mindfulness whatsoever toward what the privacy implications of that were, because they thought they were being good. Well, we're not, it's all anonymous. We're not really looking at you personally, yada, yada, yada. But the truth is that we've had advertising since the mid 90s. We've had advertising as long as we've had e-commerce. Most of it wasn't based on spying. Now most of it is. It's a very complex four-dimensional shell game. The spying part of which is ad tech. And that has become normalized to such an extreme that two things have happened. One is that it is impossible for any agency, and I was in the agency business for a very long time, to offer anything to their clients in the without that isn't digital, then it doesn't have spying in it, because that's so normal at this point. And the other thing is that both tracking protection and ad blocking have taken off to the point that is ad blocking itself alone, for which there are no good numbers anymore, but it's probably north of 2 billion people worldwide, including mobile, is by far the largest boycott in human history. And this simple fact is kind of lost still on the advertising industry, because it's very detached from you and me, even though there are yous and me's that are in the business. And that's always been an irony of the advertising business. We've always made awful ads, even though we are people who are going to be getting the ads anyway. So they're good ads too, but they're, in any case, that we're sort of in a pickle there. But the next thing that happened is there are now laws against it. The GDPR, the California Privacy Act, the CCPA, there's a new Net Neutrality Act in Maine. There have long been privacy laws in Australia, in Canada, that have not been invoked, but if they were invoked, would pretty much outlaw the whole spying thing. We're still at a moment in time where, with your job, Dana, and you can take it from here, you're running up against this. You're trying to sell against it, especially for a magazine like us that are, we're manning the parapets in Fort Morality here, saying it's wrong to follow people. I don't care what reason you've got. You know, it's just wrong. You wouldn't allow it in the physical world, and it shouldn't be allowed in the online world either. And the simple fact is there are lots of kinds of advertising that still work great. And there's not a brand in the world that has been made by tracking-based advertising, not one. And all the brands you can name, with the single exceptions of say, Zara and Trader Joe's, which are just so good at what they do, they don't need advertising, have been made by advertising. You know about Coke, you know about Geico. I watch sports, so I know 15 minutes will save me 15% with Geico. And I can't help knowing that, because I watch a lot of sports and they sponsor a lot of sports. However, I'll never buy Geico, because we've been with Liberty Mutual for 100 years. And you know, but it helps them to know that lots of people know they exist, and that lowers sales resistance. And that kind of wisdom is sort of lost in the world of digital. And yeah. But it's where we want to be. We would like companies that want our readers to say, wait a minute, we can brand with these guys, and we can engage with them in a way that's honest, that doesn't involve spying on them. So tell us about your adventures in this frontier.
Where to begin as well, right? I mean, I've also been in this a really long time, way back into the 80s and in the tech world at IDG and different places. And, you know, that's when you would run a print ad, right? I mean, it was kind of great. That's all there was to buy. But people were, you know, buying our audience, right? They wanted to influence and reach out to that audience. And it was either somehow in print, whether it was a special supplement or an ad or whatever, right? Or maybe once in a while they'd rent our mailing list, right? And then send out a direct mail piece. But those were the ways to do that. And then into the 90s, I was at CMP and I worked on something called Chip Center, which was sort of this interesting collaboration between Avnet, Aero, and CMP. It was going to be this really cool website where design engineers could actually order that prototype semiconductor that day and get it delivered and work on their project. And it was talking about pioneers, we really were pioneers. It was completely new e-commerce, completely new having this website. And we would sell these sponsorships. So if you were a PLD, you know, guy or this guy, that guy with semiconductors or something that you wanted to sort of own that section of the site. But we sold these sections of the site for massive amounts of money. I mean, it's laughable now, but how much a sponsor would pay to own a section of the site, right? And we had nowhere near the metrics and things that you would even have even 10 years later. So that was kind of an interesting time because we were pioneers. It was really cool. Everybody loved the web, right? It was like the new thing, 1.0, right? Everybody wanted to do it. And then, of course, the dot-com. And then I ended up doing some other things and came back into the world a few years later. And that's when you really started to see just the eking away, right? Like I would go on some interviews at some trade pubs and I would, is this like a small pamphlet supplement? Like those were the magazines, right? They had gone from 2 inches thick or whatever to these teeny, teeny things. And that's when it really occurred to me, this is like mid, late 2000s, like, wow, print in at least high tech is going away, right? And obviously it has. And what was happening is everybody was going online, which was okay. You know, they were doing the banners and different branding. That was still big. It wasn't really the lead thing, but that really started coming in. And I was at 1105 at the time, and we would just sort of joke. It was like we're basically selling our database. Like at some point, some of our big advertisers, I think we're going to have every single name in the database because that's all they did was lead gen, right, for time and time and time again. Force feeding people white papers and all the rest. And same thing at every other place I've been is that it's all about leads. A little bit on the branding side, but it's hard even on the branding side, especially if you're getting those ads through agencies, then it's about viewability. Then it's about above the fold. It's like all this criteria, you know, then they'd want to cancel the program because it wasn't doing it. I mean, it's not even really anything you can do anything about because it's all this metric based. And so even that's became very difficult, even in the banner world. So really, content did start coming in. Content's pretty exciting. A lot of vendors will want to do custom content. I think that's almost in some ways been this, you know, secret saving grace of publishing, right? That they know that we can do content. And they know we have the editors and the expertise in those areas. So I think that's sort of been a life raft, but the lead part has been very, very difficult because the leads, I don't know if anybody really wants to be a lead. I mean, I've been a lead, right? I'll say, oh, that's a cool white paper. I want to look at it because it's a vendor I want to call on. So I download the white paper. My phone rings so fast. I can't believe how quickly someone is calling me. How did you get my name this fast, right? And I always joke and say, oh, I'm not a lead. I just wanted to see this white paper. But I'm not sure if anybody really wants to be hounded that way to then like buy that product, right? So it's just so much has changed. It's difficult to sort of get some traction with vendors and sort of build out programs that are long-term or even short-term, but that have measurable, realistic results versus I need leads, I need North America only, you know, company size 10,000 or bigger, only these titles, you know, I need them tomorrow and I need 50, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know if anyone can deliver that. I know a lot of publishers are forced to go outside and buy leads, telemarket, give Amazon cards away, whatever they can do to get these leads. And honestly, I don't even know how many of that ever even really turns out to great business in the first place, right? Are they even, like, do these dots connect at the end of the day? But marketing people and ad people are chartered and challenged with getting leads. That's really mostly what their job is, leads.
An interesting thing, 2 years ago, it was in October of 17, I was at an offsite thing just for people who are in the service business, in the service side of big vendors. You're talking about really big ones here and all name brands that you've heard of. And one of them had just pulled $100 million out of ad tech. And they were entirely in the lead generation business. I can't say what their business was, but suffice it to say that they could run ads that said, hey, and I'll make up a category. Hey, college graduate, if you need this, call this number or right here. And then that they could run ads like that. And then they could run ads that were based entirely on spying on people that went after leads that basically just gave them a whole bunch of names and numbers, or ones where even people opted in and filled something out. And what they found was the quality of the leads that they got from plain old direct response, you know, say, here, write to us at this number, and there's your metric. They wrote to us at that number, worked better than the kind where they were spying on people. And yet that was not intelligence they wanted to share with anybody else.
Right.
And also the market was big enough that they could pull $100 million out and it didn't make much difference. Right. And that's another thing. It's like, who knew that so-and-so pulled out? I mean, if Nike pulls out of sponsoring sports, you know about it, right? But yeah. If this company pulled out of sponsoring, not even because there was no sponsoring involved, because sponsoring it means you're actually you're supporting something, right? And
yeah. And visual.
Yeah, and the problem with the spying-based ads, and this goes to content, not exactly the kind of content you were talking about, but content in a very large sense. If what you're doing is chasing eyeballs, then what the publishers need to do, including dishonest ones, is just coat the world in content. You make up anything, and including all the fake news. You know, Pope endorses Trump is one of the biggest examples. And that was done by teenagers in Macedonia that wanted in on Google's AdSense or whatever it was at the time, which is they just create a whole bunch of fake websites. They create a bunch of fake news. It's much easier to write that crap than it is to actually do any real reporting. And as a result, the world is filled with content. I mean, there's a newspaper that I grew up with, the Newark Star Ledger in New Jersey. And there was a New York Times piece a year ago in January that quoted from their pitches for reporters saying, we're looking for content producers to produce all the content they can. And that was all so they could play in the ad tech game of having as much crap out there as possible to catch as much advertising as possible. None of which is sponsoring them, you know, which is what, you know, a car dealer used to do, which is like, we want people who read the Newark Star Ledger who are in New Jersey and might want to buy a Ford. And that's all kind of gone out the window. But I wonder whether, is there any sign that the tide is turning a little bit on this? Do you see any?
Such a tough question. I mean, I guess what's interesting is coming over here sort of woke me up to something I've thought about for years, right? Like, hey, they're embarking on turning this tide. They're taking a stance, right? They're not doing this anymore. And now, of course, I would say we're not because I'm here. And that was new to me because I have not had that conversation anywhere else that I've been. It's been, this is what we do. Oh, we need more leads. Let's go outsource. Let's find another vendor to do it for us. Let's don't tell them where we're getting the leads. We're just going to do it this way. They'll get their leads. I mean, so to suddenly like that conversation is gone and we're not talking about that anymore was sort of refreshing. And it gave me sort of an opportunity when I'm talking with vendors to explain a little bit more how we work, how what our readers are looking for, what we want to offer, and our charter versus going down some rabbit hole of constant leads. So I really do think that Linux Journal is sort of ahead of its time at the moment with this conversation. I don't think this is at all bad news at all to any reader. I don't think any reader really wants to be constantly lead gen, you know, like, where are they? I think that they like getting, you know, the, even the old days, a magazine to read or reading stories on the site or getting the newsletter and seeing what the latest news is that week. And, oh, hey, there's a webinar coming up. I'd love to attend. I think I'll register, right? I don't think any reader out there ever wanted any of the journalism that we've done for 30 years to go away. I think that sort of the marketing and the companies decided that. So I think that there's a real opportunity. Just even Catherine and you, when you both have done the podcast recently on sort of the security issues and talking to those couple of companies we talked to about what's going on. And those are fascinating podcasts, right? And I think that those are also topics that are probably becoming more and more interesting to our advertisers of thinking like, hey, yeah, this is really the strange road we've been going on. Maybe we want to get back into actual like real marketing and real advertising and real promos. But I think it's tough because like we had sort of encountered this morning, even if the vendor would love to do a program with us, if you have an ad agency who is stuck in a certain way of doing it or is forced to with some charter, we've got to do leads and it's got to be done a certain way. It's very hard to get around that because they're sort of being held a certain way. The you know, so it's, what do you do, right? Luckily there's some vendors who don't go down those certain paths of that lead generation. So it's easier, but I believe that after almost right 20 years of this, I do believe that we're probably going to start seeing sort of this new wave coming in, but I'm not sure how fast that's going to be. I'm amazed how long this wave has gone and how really sort of detrimental it's been. I I've enjoyed parts of it, but I've also just, I'm amazed at sort of the wreckage that we have left behind, right? Yeah. In the journalism world that we loved and grew up with, and all the great things that came out of that, but it's kind of gone, and it is shocking. So,
you know, I know from where you worked, I'm imagining is Drake Lundell still around? You were at CMP. Do you remember Drake Lundell?
I didn't.
Okay.
I was in the electronics group.
Yeah. So, I'm thinking also of Pat McGovern and Bill.
Oh, yeah. Biff, yeah.
So Pat's gone and Bill's gone too. But back when I was in the agency business, I'm thinking Pat and Bill must be spinning in their graves right now over what's happened. This is anecdotal, but it was really interesting. So we had a pretty successful ad agency in Silicon Valley. You know, we were in Palo Alto, and we advertised a lot, big double truck, you know, artsy ads in PC Magazine and all the big thick pubs, you know, the ones that were that thick way back when. And there was one particular event in Aspen, Colorado, which is where Bill Ziff lived, in an amazing house filled with Anasazi art overlooking the valley there, that you got to like in a ski mobile and stuff, you know, and it was in the winter. And we were at I forget the name of the hotel, but it was the Jerome. It was a very famous hotel in downtown Aspen. And he brought all his agency people into a room, and he just gave everybody the most amazing shit. He said, okay, I know you guys are all like, you like to do art. Let me tell you something about our readers. You know, our readers want to know what, they don't care about your art. Here's what they want to know. What does this cost? They want to know, why is this better than that? And he brought out Computer Shopper. I don't know if you remember Computer Shopper. Yeah. Computer Shopper was also about yay thing. It was on newsprint. There wasn't a beautiful ad in it. He said, this is by far the most successful thing we have.
Yeah.
And it's the most successful thing we have because it is nothing but useful information. All of his ads is all useful information. Here's what this motherboard goes for. This is what this Ethernet chip does. This is what this, a card that goes in the back of a PC does, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And it was great because, you know, he kind of gave us truth about what readers actually want. And what we're getting now, because there's such a distance between the people wanting the metrics and the people who are the subject of the metrics, that the disconnect is absolute. I mean, the point you're making earlier, like, you don't want to be a lead. Nobody wants to think of themselves as a lead. Nobody thinks of themselves as wanting to go into a funnel, a sales funnel of all things, you know. It's like a drain. You know, I'm going to go down a drain. You know, no customer thinks they're in a journey. You know, that's another one that the marketers have to talk about. I'm on a journey. Everybody's on a journey. You know, nobody booked the journey. Nobody knows they're on this journey, right? You know, and where I go with that, I remember when I was again in the agency business and also in PR, and in those days, this is back in the late 80s, early 90s, there were no CMOs. CMO didn't exist yet. In fact, marketing had no stature whatsoever within a company.
Right.
But there was a VP. There were no directors. There were no chief X's. There were directors and there were VPs, right? And nobody wants to be a VP anymore. But back then there were VPs. And there was always a VP of sales and marketing. Never just sales or marketing. There was a sales and marketing VP.
Right.
And I asked Joyce, my wife, who was, you know, in business and very successful at it. I said, so why is it that all VPs of sales and marketing are from sales and not from marketing? And she said, well, it's real easy. Sales is real and marketing is bullshit. And and then she quickly added, she said, no, it's not that marketing has to be, it's just, it's political. She said, because sales owns the customer contact. And marketing can't, because that's treading on sales turf. So, and then she used air quotes and said, well, marketing has to be strategic like this. And we're still there. You know, marketing thinks it's closer to the customer because they have more data about the customer or about the prospect, but it's all surreptitious. It's all sneaky. It's not real.
Right.
And what Bill Ziff was talking about is, he has readers. The readers pay him money. The readers, they know who the readers are. And the readers do these things, and the readers appreciate this or that, and they, and And part of the selection is, are you subscribing to this magazine? You care about PCs. You know, you're subscribing to EE Times. You care about electrical engineering.
You care about
chips. You care about memory. You care about this kind of stuff. And it was self-selecting. And there were some really creative ways of using it. I don't know if you remember this, but on the front page of, I think it was Computer World. It was Computer World when Computer World mattered. And the lower right corner was bought by Larry Ellison at Oracle, when Oracle was and also ran. And it was nothing but seminars. It was like, we're going all over the country and we're talking about Oracle. If you want to come by, like, call this number and book it. That was the whole thing. And he filled the rooms because they gave a good show. And that was that's how Oracle made itself, was with these silly ads on the front page of Computer World. They had no art to them at all. And in fact, when there was a point where they wanted to hire our agency, and in particular, you know, they liked the work of my partner, who is the other creative director. I was a creative director, but I was the copy guy. He was the art guy, a guy named Ray Simone. And what Larry wanted was, he was going to do the creative with Ray, kind of like Steve Jobs did the creative with his friends he smoked dope with at Chiat Day. And and Ray said no. He could not imagine being in a room with Larry Ellison. But that was at a time when what Larry really wanted was a relationship with his customer.
Yeah.
You know, he really wanted that.
Yeah.
And what we've done is we've used data as a way to distance ourselves.
Yes.
From human beings and how human beings, you know, why do they read this? Why do they do that?
Yeah.
And so much of it is just, you know, let people know you're making a good product, you know, let them know you're making a good, and then, you know, it's an old saying, you know, make a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. Getting better data doesn't make a better mousetrap necessarily.
Yeah. You know?
But you're right. We are ahead of our time. And I think we are at this point pretty much alone. I mean, I know of three or four companies, not in the publishing business, but have expressed an interest in agreeing to terms that the reader asserts, that says, go ahead and show me ads. Just make sure they're not based on tracking me, or just basically don't track me.
Yeah.
You know, but most publications, what most of them have done is, they fired the people we used to work with on the sales side. You know, they fired that whole team. They're not working there anymore. Instead, they jobbed it out, not to the agencies, but to the intermediaries that are working with the agencies. And their excuse is, and this is something I've heard from Condé Nast over and over again, oh, well, we can't stop tracking you because that's what the agencies want. And the agencies only do what the advertisers want. And I don't think that's entirely true. I think those businesses can change. But it's going to take whapping them upside the head a few times in some ways. I don't know how.
I mean, it's just, when you're saying something about data, you know, isn't a relationship and all, I mean, that's, I think also something, you know, it's kind of funny, right? When you live long enough, then you see all this stuff. Like when you're younger, you think, oh, I wish I knew that. And then later you're like, God, I don't know if I want to have lived long enough to go back 30 years. Ah, but I mean, that's what our jobs as the salespeople on these different publications, right? Probably salespeople everywhere, was about going to see people. And I didn't have to bang you over the head, like practically beg you to see me. Like, oh, sure, next week at 11, just have lunch. And so they wanted you to be out seeing people, but it wasn't hard. It wasn't like, oh, I can't get anybody to see me. So you'd have a lot of meetings, or you'd go to trade shows or whatever. You would see people, and it was all connected that way, right? And definitely in the last decade, and I know it's not just me because I don't think I changed anything, it is ridiculously hard even to get people to either call or write you, but to try to see people. And I'm talking people that are right here in Seattle that I would love to go see. 50 miles away, I can't even get them to write me back, let alone meet. And I think that that's been a very strange thing for me, that people no longer want to meet. It's like they want to hide, buy some leads. And I think they're probably still all lovely people, but something has happened in that human interaction in this kind of work where people are very reticent to meeting and talking, because in the talking, right, is where you say, oh, okay, that's really what you're chartered with this quarter. Well, maybe we can build this, right, and talk about it or show a sample. But it's so hard to do all that in an email or a quick Zoom call, right? Like, So that's been, I think, one of the difficult parts of this type of job is almost losing like a leg or an arm, right? Like, oh, I can't depend on that anymore. I'm going to do that. And that sort of always was my favorite part of the role, was going on meetings.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was thinking that there were a bunch of people at my wedding in 1991 who were in the publishing business, you know, that I knew that I had a zillion lunches with. And not about business necessarily. You know, I mean, you know, we were at the time a pretty big agency. They were a pretty big publisher, you know, IDG and CMP and Ziff were the big ones, but there were some others too. And you know, we just became friends, right? You know, I had a lot of friends in that business and you know, we could talk about how it was changing and how at that time it wasn't changing that fast, but it was changing a lot because it was computing. I mean, it went from mainframes to PCs. It went from, you know, LANs and WANs to the internet. It went, big to small and from corporate to personal and a bunch of other changes like that. A thought I'm having right now is there still are human beings somewhere there that you're trying to get in touch with. And maybe what we need, and maybe people watching this can help us with this, or listening to this, because it'll be audio as well. Not just sales material, but what should be a pitch for you, right? To go to these people saying, you know what, guys, your business is about to get blown up. Okay, do you know that? I mean, look, see what's happening with the GDPR? See what's happening with the California Privacy Act? You see what's happening with all this other stuff? You know that there are 2 billion people blocking ads right now? That didn't happen in a vacuum. That's going to blow up in your face. Look at the level of fraud and malware out there, which is unbelievably huge. I mean, it's just massive. Do you want to work on what's the next thing here? You know, what's the ethical way to do this? Because we're working on that. We're trying to figure it out. You want to join us on that? Let's talk. You know, something like that. I'm thinking that there's some kind of evangelism here that may not result in an immediate sale, but it still at least involves starting with human beings, you know, I'm not here to sell you. I'm here to talk about what's going down in your business. You know, there's major leakage going down there below your slaves. and what are we going to do about that? And by the way, we have to release your slaves too. Yeah. You know, that's. Yeah.
That's. Well, and I had one manager, you know, would say, oh, well, maybe you can't get as many meetings. You have to be bringing them interesting things. I'm not disagreeing with that, but it's like, well, I don't know. Again, I need to not have a big agenda to come see you. It was more collaborative because I think, right, the vendors and the publishers were sort of in it together, right? We were both talking to these readers. So we were bringing the news and information. The vendors were bringing marketing information that they wanted to convey to them. And so we were sort of this joint team. And it wasn't like one of us upping the other. But what happened is I think vendors don't appreciate us maybe as much anymore, or the journalistic value that we bring in, the readers we bring, because the readers truly are our customer, right? If we didn't have readers, we wouldn't even be around. Nobody would even decide that Catherine so lovely manages for us, right? That we wouldn't have anybody. So the readers are the key to all of this, and that just shows how well read we are with the huge audience we have, even our darker times. The audience never goes away. They never say, oh, there's not as many ads, or I'm not a lead this week. I don't think I'll read Linux Journal, right? So it's strange that part is sort of a disconnect. But I think that if we could sort of bridge that again with that we're in partnership with everybody. It's not either or. And that, you know, really they can't, one really can't live without the other, right? Because vendors really can't market without the audiences that we bring. Because it's not like hundreds of people go to their website. I mean, probably not at all, right? They don't get that much traffic. And the journalism that our readers are reading through us is really what attracts them. They might Google something to find a product or whatever, but they still come back to our sites or other sites, right, to read what's going on and get the news and information they need to do their jobs. So we're an integral part of any market, but certainly the tech market. So it's a super, super important part. And I'm frustrated that it's sort of sort of been marginalized over the years. And I mean, we were talking earlier about just the, like, and, you know, whether you worked at IDG or CMP or any of these big publishers, even the smaller ones, there would be like, you know, 5, 6, 7 or more people like me, right, covering the country. Now, there's like one or two. Because there's not the dollars that there used to be. So it is strange to see it evaporate like that when it doesn't really make any sense to me. And I was going to say, it's funny when I sort of go to a vendor site and read about them, right? And then I realize, oh my gosh, their ad is following me all over the internet. It's like,
right, yeah, oh, it is, because they're tracking you like a mark enemy.
Because I see, it's like, oh, I wish we could get that banner on Linux Journal. They've got one, they're running it. But that's how you can see how easy it is that everybody uses AdWords, because their ads then follow readers all over the place. But, and they're not getting me in the environment. That's the other thing I think is super important, to have messaging be in the environment that actually makes sense to that reader, right? Like when they're engaged in a story and they're seeing something relevant, versus it's the weekend, they want to catch up on CNN. I mean, they might see an ad and say, oh, hey, that's interesting, maybe, maybe not. But it's not really in that wheelhouse of what they're doing right then, right? They're not really working about, you know, they're doing fun stuff right now. And that's also strange to me, just how these ads are ubiquitous everywhere, really where it's not, where the reader really is doing their work. And I don't know if that's
something you said earlier about the audience not going away, though. I feel like I need to kind of interject that the audience has changed significantly, though, in that they haven't gone away, but they're far more hidden and untrackable than they ever have been.
Oh, you know, right,
if you look
at
our stats over the years, you know, if you look at something like a, you know, Google Analytics, you would think that our readership is dying, right? But it's in fact not, because if you look at server stats or CDN stats, you know, they're still there. They're just blocking anything that has the ability to identify them. And in our case, it's massive. It's a much higher percentage of our audience, I think, than other publications. So I think that's, you know, that's important information. Like, if you want to reach people who are tech savvy and aware of the tracking that's going on, you can't use the same old tricks. And then I think that, you know, we've talked a lot about things that have changed, right? All of the things that have changed in advertising over the last 30 years. But we haven't talked a lot about all the stuff that hasn't changed, you know? There are a lot of things that haven't changed, and that is, you know, what the information that people are looking for. People are still looking for how to do my job better, you know, how to build something cool with a Raspberry Pi. You know, interesting information is interesting, right? So, I don't know. I think there's...
That's an interesting point, and I think that is why webinars continue to do well. People will register for them, right?
Yeah, I do. Can,
because you're right, that there, it's information they need, or, hey, that's the challenge I've got, or that's a neat vendor I wanted to hear from. You know, they've got a case study or whatever it is. So that is, because webinars were sort of the new soup du jour, right, in the early 2000s. But they've consistently, at least in the tech side, done pretty well with registrations and attendance, because people do want that information. And I'm glad to see, I always say, thank God webinars aren't going away, right? Like, they're still popular. So yeah, they're not being, and you know, it's usually what, you know, maybe 2-3 email blasts to promote it. Like, they're not being force fed a webinar for 6 months, right? So it's self-serving. Oh, this sounds neat to me, I'm going to register, I want to attend. So I think it's a very low level sort of way to be marketed to, but they're going to go. And also it helps on our side with our editorial team to write, say, well, you know, I like that topic, but I might want to go this way. I think our readers are going to like that a little bit better, right? So that's really where the editorial expertise comes in. We're to help guide the vendor what the reader wants to learn about. But yeah, webinars are just consistently do well.
Several thoughts, because we're in several different strings we can kind of pull down here. One was on retargeting, you know, where you're, you know, the ad for something follows you around for the next 10 websites or so. That's only been around since 2012 or so. And it's interesting, Don Marty, who I advise people who like this podcast to look at an earlier one we did with Don Marty, who's now with Mozilla, but used to be our editor-in-chief actually here at Linux Journal, and who studied this stuff a great deal. But he was the one who pointed out that searches for retargeting, mostly by people inside the business, were almost exactly matched by searches for how to block ads and searches for ad blocking, because people clearly knew that they were being followed once they started seeing retargeting, something that people in the business probably didn't look at. Another was that one of the paid gigs I had as a consultant a couple of years ago was going to one of the companies that does this kind of thing. They wanted to kind of get my wisdom on it. And when I talked to him about retargeting, this guy said, how many times do you think somebody needs to see a retargeted ad before they click on it? I said, I don't know, tell me. He said, 72. And I said, how do you know that on the 72nd time somebody just didn't click on it by mistake? And he actually said, it doesn't matter. We got the metric. We got the metric. That's all that mattered, right? And yeah. And that's, you know, the moral corruption behind that is kind of absolute in a way. And but that's one thing that's sort of interesting, that not all the practices that are going on within the business have happened all at once. You know, retargeting is 2012, is not that long ago. It's like 7 years, yeah. You know, something like that. And you know, and it's already been mocked by The Onion, which had a story a couple of years ago that said woman stalked against 10 websites by obsessed shoe advertisement, right? You know, so I think there's a journalistic side to this that I think there are a couple things. One is on the webinar side, I think people hunger for engagement, period. I think that's something we tend not to have in this digital world, where we have less of it. And I think webinars are one of the ways that you can have a sense of being engaged with people. The most quoted thing I ever wrote was Markets or Conversations, which was in the original Clutrain manifesto and probably launched a lot of marketing since then. But I think that's true. Those are conversational. People like conversations. So I just wanted to kind of reinforce that. But I have a journalistic thought about a kind of a pitch. And that is, in journalism, we're always writing stories. What's a story? Well, a story has three parts. It has three elements. There's a character, a protagonist, doesn't matter what it is. You can like him or hate him. It could be a team. It could be a political party. It could be a cause. It could be a person. Doesn't matter. And then there has to be a problem, because problems will keep you turning the page, and movement toward a resolution. So there are two problems, I think, for your prospects, that which are our prospects, you know. But one is brand safety, what they're calling brand safety, which is, you know, what are you doing for your reputation, guys? You know, the other is ad fraud. I mean, the amount of fraud and malware that's at loose in this system is absolutely massive. And there's some really good hard numbers that we got from this guy named Dr. Augustine Fu, who I think he's... Catherine, has he been on yet? He's been on, hasn't he?
Yes, we did.
He has been on. So he's another one you can go back and look at or listen to. We can't look at that one. You can look at it. You just won't see anything. You just hear it. But anyway, it's like, yeah, we like to watch TV. We just don't turn it on. anyway, but he has some numbers on this that are kind of massive. And I think that's – there is something afoot here, because in just the last, like, there was a period, like, in April when Joyce and I started hearing from, we heard from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, AP, the Atlantic, and a senator's office. All of them had read stuff that I'd written about what's gone wrong with the advertising business. And I've been challenging the big publishers of the world to own up and grab the third rail of their participation in the system, that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all of them, the Washington Post is the most recent one that I kind of busted for this, are all reporting, you know, off their high horse on what Facebook and Google are doing, when in fact everybody knows what Facebook and Google are doing.
Right.
And in fact, people opt into that shit. They don't opt into it with the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. Yeah. And all of them have contacted us, and none of them have been willing to go out on a limb yet. But one, in fact, from the New York Times a few days ago said, please keep the pressure up. There is a tide turning here. There is the beginning of signs that, wait a minute, this is wrong. It reminds me a lot of the tobacco industry a long time ago. In fact, a number of people have said that the ad industry today, the online ad industry, is the tobacco industry of our time. You know, they're fully rationalized doing the wrong thing, you might say. And the difference is there is no better way to smoke tobacco, right? There is a better way to advertise, right? So I think that there's hope here, and I think we are ahead of our time. There's no doubt about it.
Oh yeah.
But we've staked out a place. You know, we've staked out a place where people are going to come, and it's a good place, right? It's not a, you know, I mean, we've owned our own issues with this, you know, and I'm still doing it. I mean, I have a blog at Harvard, and a number of people have pointed out, well, Harvard has 12 trackers on there, and I've tried to get somewhere with that. I haven't, you know, so far. But as Catherine knows, we've sort of ratcheted down from way below normal to none on our own site.
I mean, to be fair, we still have New Relic. We have some server data. It's not ad technology, but, you know, we have as little as we can get away with and still have a functional site.
Yeah, but part of the problem here, and even a Privacy Badger and BayCloud Bouncer and others like that haven't done their full job on this, which is what are the harmless kind and how are they harmless? You know, if we're only using New Relic for this or that, it's a kind of harmless thing and it's not really screwing you in
as
some
far
way.
As far as we know.
As far as we know. See, that's another thing, you know, so, you know, this is
whole other conversation.
Well, yeah, I know I had an editor 1,000 years ago who I won't name, but he was great. And this is a small magazine. It had a very loyal following, and he was cheating on his wife, and he was lying about it, and it was a whole kind of controversy that came out about it. He was, I think, by far the best editor I ever had, you know, and I wrote, you know, I was asked to defend him, and I said, well, look, you know, our idols walk on clay feet when it's the only way to get around, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of that. I mean, we all do the best we can in a world where there is no perfect thing to do. And there, you know, we don't, perfect isn't a full choice yet. Right. Unless you just want to stay offline, you know, but perfect wins you points. You know, I mean, that's where Richard Stallman has been forever, you know, and he's got the perfect position for what his moral standing is, but he never uses the cloud. Well, try and get along without that as a developer today, right?
At a certain point you have to, you know, just, you have to be as informed as possible, and you have to identify, you know, trusted companies. And I'm sure, like, I want to point out, I'm sure New Relic is totally fine and is not doing anything weird with
please don't be weird with their stuff.
Please don't be weird. But, you know, I think people are increasingly suspect of every single thing that loads as they should be. I mean, people being our audience, the rest of the world, maybe not so much. But, you know, there is one thing that you mentioned earlier that I kind of wanted to get back to, and that is the conversation about, you know, how many times you have to see some information, you know, retargeting and whatnot before it's effective. And that reminded me, as long as we're plugging previous podcast episodes, that we had the one about that stalking service. And it was
I know.
Because there were, you know, we talk about all of these things, and a lot of people, I can't tell you how many people tell me, yeah, well, you know, I actually kind of like ads that are relevant to me. You know, I like being, I would prefer being served only ads that are relevant to me than, you know, general ones. And you think, okay, well, people don't perceive that they're being harmed.
Right.
People don't yet perceive that they're being harmed by this technology that's so pervasive. But that's not necessarily true now, right? I mean, now people are starting to truly use it to do harm, arguably.
Well, they may not be. I mean, I think we have to admit that in many cases, that there is, you know, that this is an issue I learned from hanging out at law schools, you know, that you don't have a case unless you've got a harm, you know. So and it's pretty hard to establish that in many cases because people don't feel harmed. It's kind of like, you know, it's like identity theft or something. People, a lot of people are exposed to that. I just went through something where I got a, with one of the companies that I deal with, I won't say it, but they, you know, I got a note saying somebody from Nanking in China is trying to log in as you. And here's the password. It's like, holy shit. You know, so, and I had to go and change that. And it like took 2 days of my life to deal with that. And that's, and it's still a problem because I have to like walk around with that password in my pocket because the damn thing is not, I don't have, I mean, the password service that I use is not good enough for that. You know, I mean, they're just not. And I could go on about it, but the thing is that I don't know where I was going to go with that, but.
Well, the question of harm.
Harm, right. Yeah. So, but it's kind of like, you know, again, it's like with tobacco. I mean, you know, you have 10 or 15 cigarettes. You smoke for the time you're 15 to 22 and you're 80, you know, 48 now. And does this matter anymore? Probably not, you know, but and maybe it did, you know, you could say, you know, it's cumulative. You don't know what it's going to be. But I think that the question with relevant ads is really not whether they're relevant or not, but it's who they're up to, mm-hmm. you know, and how do you get them? I mean, if you told people, okay, here's how we get relevant ads for you. We're going to tattoo a QR code on your arm. So that could be scanned everywhere. How about that? Everybody would say no, right? You know, we're gonna plant a tracking beacon on you like you would in your dog in case it gets lost that you're gonna wear everywhere.
I think exactly, a lot of people would say yes. That's the
Let them say yes. At least there's knowledge about it. But right now the assumption by the entire ad tech industry is no, that's okay. It's okay to do that, and they don't know. And we're seeing that especially now with the GDPR, because what the GDPR has done so far is separate the wheat from the chaff in the consent system, right? Which is that you have to consent to being followed, you know, and I was in another call before this call where somebody pointed out, somebody who knows a lot more than I do, that if you consent to anything online right now, I guarantee you it has tracking behind it. You've just agreed to being tracked. And on so many sites, there's no choice about that. You have to consent to being tracked. And that's not why the GDPR happened. The GDPR happened because there was tracking going on. Now consenting to being tracked is just, you know, is just makes it worse. And it throws this awful barrier up in front of every website, you know? So anyway.
I think also it's important to remind people that the same technology that, you know, enables relevant advertising, which may seem benign, is also powering things like the ability to manipulate an election or the ability for somebody to pay $30 to some website in Germany or wherever it was from, I can't remember, which will, you know, convince some coworker to quit their job because you don't like them. You know, I think there are actually some.
Right. Yeah.
Important to realize that this it's not necessarily benign. Just because it is in many cases doesn't mean it always is.
Yeah, and I think there's also, I mean, I view it as there's sort of your off time, your consumer, oh, I want to buy a pair of shoes, oh, I went to, you know, such and such, and now an ad followed me to People magazine. But if I'm a developer, an IT guy, whatever, and I'm doing my work, I'm not really buying like a consumer, right? Like it's a very different mindset. It's very technical, high end, high stake. It's a different way of being marketed and engaged to, and you know, your journey. It's not the same thing, right? And that's where I just get frustrated in anything sort of, certainly in the high tech world, that the marketing and the readers and the journalism, it's all a very different world. And it really needs to keep on that path that we've been on forever, like you said, back in the days of Pat McGovern, right? Where it's who I started working for when I was in my early 20s. I just like admired him, right? Oh, Pat McGovern's coming to the office and he had such
a
vision and went around the world starting all these computer worlds. And I mean, it was an unbelievably fascinating time for me, sort of being in that beginning of the computers anyways, and then being in this publishing company and seeing what was going on. And so it's shocking to me now, like we've said, those are gone away or tiny vision versions of the mold cells, and that we've dumbed down and changed the way we market to these really, really sophisticated, really bright readers. And I would like to get back more to that sort of promotion that you used to see and let the consumer world be the consumer world. Like, I think it's odd. I really do. I can't imagine when they say Facebook and Google, you know, own a huge amount of all the ad dollars, right? My husband and I, neither one of us are on Facebook. I haven't been on it in 10 years. I have no interest. I would never spend 5 minutes of my day. I just don't care. But I find it hard to believe that anybody really engaged in a very high-end technical career is going to Facebook looking for information. I don't think about it that way. I just think they're, why would they? I mean, so maybe I'm missing out because I'm not over there, but I just think of that again, more consumer, a cool trip, a great restaurant, a new air conditioner for your home, whatever, but not really in the trades and the technical world. So, and I don't know, but I'm shocked that so much of the ad spending is going, you know, to that duopoly. I didn't even really realize this so recently, that it just blows my mind that that's where people are spending their money. I don't know, think I disconnect.
I was at a party in the UK weekend before last.
You're so international.
I know. I really I know it's true. This is this great party, this rural place. So one of the people there worked for Facebook. And I said, okay, I've heard this and I want you to tell me if it's true, which is the vast majority of the money Facebook makes is from stuff that most of us among the cognoscenti don't see because it's so mundane. For example, you know, a guy who likes fly fishing, who's going to the Rogue River, and says so on Facebook, is going to see ads for a fishing tackle place on Rogue River. And it's not a whole lot of money, and it's not stuff the rest of us see. I mean, when we had print publications and they were all the same thing for everybody who subscribed,
right.
You know, those are one kind of advertising. He said, by far, he said he'd get me some numbers, but I haven't seen it yet. I said, I want to see that, because he said the truth is, most of the advertising going on Facebook is that kind of thing. It's small. Okay. It's very small potatoes. And in the same way that, I mean, we know for a fact that 60-some% of Google's money comes from ad words that, though may have tracking in it, for the most part, could live without being tracking based. In a similar way, there's something going on with Facebook that basically replaces the local newspaper.
Right.
That's what it does. It basically replaces the ads in the local newspaper and the ads in you know, Field and Stream, right? In the case of that one, or a travel magazine, if it's ads for cruises or something.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of interesting to me that the extent of my involvement with Facebook is relatives that are nowhere else.
Right.
And that's one thing. But the other, which is much more to the degree it's part of my life, there are a couple that have to do with radio, like old radio. These are people who were in radio a long time and are either still doing engineering in radio or something like that. And it's interesting to me, there's one in particular, very active group on Facebook called I Take Pictures of Transmitter Sites. And I've probably had 50 photos in this thing. And because this is something I do. It's because I like to study infrastructure, and that's part of it, and it's something I know a lot about. It's like knowing about steam power or knowing how to create stone tools. But I have never seen a single ad anywhere on that list, in that group, for anything having to do with engineering or anything like the topic at all. It's sort of interesting to me, and maybe I would think if I were ERI or Shively or Dielectric or Nautel, or I'm running on names of big brands that speak to those people, and which I've qualified myself as one, I suppose.
Right.
I would see ads for that, but I'm not. It's really weird, you know. But and so part of the problem that I'm talking about here, in a much larger sense, is none of us has a clear picture as an individual, not even just as a user, whatever that means anymore, but as a person in the digital world, of what's actually going on.
Yeah.
We don't know. I mean, you know, we walk out in the physical world and we know if the sun comes up, we're all seeing the sun come up, right? Yeah. There it is. We see that. And, you know, some friends of mine from years ago who are Native Americans pointed out that, you know, everybody in their nation knew if they looked at the moon, no matter where they were all seeing the same thing. And they were part of the same thing because there's the moon, right? And there, or there's the sun. And that's something we all had in common, right? And there, we don't have that in the tracking-based advertising world, or even in the, if it's not tracking-based. I mean, it, with Facebook, the kind of advertising I'm talking about there is not especially pernicious at all. It's that it's totally context-based. And context-based is one of those things, you know, like, and that's probably a sell for you as well. You want context? I have a whole bunch of context for you here with Linux developers. By the way, these are the people that are making the world. You may have heard of Linux. We help make that happen. These guys are making the world, okay? There's not that many of them that are paying attention, but they really matter, and because they're making the world.
Yeah.
But that's context-based, and context-based can work, right?
Yeah.
And Facebook has a case they could make there. It just, if all they did was context-based, you know, you're on your news feed and you write about Niagara Falls, maybe you see an ad for, you know, the Buffalo Bills or something like that, you know, or for something in Toronto or ice wine in near Niagara Falls or some other thing that's relevant. And that's pretty innocent stuff, honestly. And it's sort of a mark of how, this is a side point, how remarkably tone deaf and stupid Facebook actually is. I mean, it really is. I'm amazed at how they've not said anything that made any sense for years. I mean, from Zuckerberg on down, they've said nothing that makes sense or that would really defend what they do, you know?
Yeah.
Not there, you know? You know, so like even the numbers I just didn't get from this guy, you know, they're, send me those numbers, you know, that'll help. That'll help your cause, but oh well. But anyway, the point there is context-based, because I mean, context is another thing that's pretty close to branding, you know, as something that's, you want relevance. You don't have to spy on people in order to get relevance, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess that's just what goes back to what we're saying. In the old days, oh, I want to reach, you know, the Linux user, right? And there's five places that really, really focus on it. Got great journalism. And I know the editors. Like, this is where we have to be. This is, obviously, it makes sense. I mean, which is sort of the dream of being in vertical markets, right? Like, you sell saws or you sell engineering equipment or whatever. There's certain publications or websites that focus on that. You know that's where your readers are. That's where they're going to get their information, obviously, right? And they have the numbers to show you.
Yeah.
So that's where you want to put your messaging, because it's a relevant context for them, right? They're in the workday or off hours, but that's what they're reading about. That's where they're looking for that. When they're having fun and looking at, you know, ESPN or whatever, maybe they don't really want work ads following them around, or like you said, they're blocking them anyways. So I guess, I mean, it's almost like I almost feel like it's a hindrance that I kind of grew up in the time of journalism, right? Like the real trade publications and the big newsrooms, you know, they had 50 editors, right? And there was just so much energy, and the publisher ran around the country, and there was just so much going on that's why I say you live long enough, you can go back in time. It's like, and it doesn't exist anymore. And I'm sad, and I don't know where it went. And I don't know how it disappeared to this world that I sort of don't recognize, and seems silly and futile to me that this is what it's become, because I don't think a world like that existed because it wasn't necessary and important. It was a wonderful place to be. And I hate to see it just, like you said, Pat McGovern would, you know, just die right now again, to see how it's just etched away to like a lead. Like you said, they're on their journey. I mean, it's just silly. And yet I didn't know I'd live long enough. I never even envisioned back in the mid to late 80s that this would ever be a conversation I'd be having right now. I had no idea, right, where things were going. They've really gone south in certainly the last 10 years.
Well, I think, you know, there's a principle that says in technology, what can be done will be done until we figure out what's wrong with it, right? You know, it's like, and sometimes it takes a long time. Like, hey, let's set fire to leaves and breathe in the smoke. Well, maybe that wasn't a bad idea, but like it took 400 years to discover that. But on the other hand, I think there's you know, it took a lot less time than nuclear power, right? We said, wait a minute, we could split the atom and we could cause big explosions. What are we going to do? Hey, let's blow up a couple cities. Okay, we did that. We're never going to do that again.
Yeah.
And I think we're reaching that point right now with spying on people. I think that's pretty much the case.
I think you're right.
We need digital technology. Digital technology makes a lot of things easy. We really want data, but there are some problems with data. If you have too much of it, suddenly you've got a toxic asset. I mean, that's one of the big lessons that all the big companies are learning right now, which is, wait a minute, I maybe don't need to have all this data in one place because it could be stolen. And then all of a sudden, you know, like, who is it? Oh, British Airways, right? They're being fined like $2 billion or something crazy like that by the British government for,
really?
because they got hacked and all of their, you know, all their customers, something like that. Please, anybody watching or listening to this, double check me on that because I'm just going by memory. But but the British office of whatever it is, you know, definitely dinged somebody recently for this particular thing. And you know, we're at the point where we're, I think, discovering what too far is, you know, and
yes.
and now we can come back. I don't think the world that you and I lived in the publishing world is going to recreate itself, you know, and, but I do think journalism itself, writing good stories that are fact-based about stuff that matters, or even trivia about stuff that doesn't matter, but it's interesting. I mean, all of it, you know, is, that's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. I think being fraudulent in it and gaming advertising systems with it is going to go away somehow. And it's probably not going to be Google and Facebook that make it go away. And I don't think it's going to be new laws that make it go away. I think it's just going to be, changes in the zeitgeist that's no longer okay.
Yeah. You
know, I saw it happen with drunk driving. I mean, and that was pretty much changed by yeah. You know, when I was in North Carolina in the 60s in college, there were stats that said one out of every 25 people coming at you after dark was drunk. Yeah. One of every 25, I mean, meaning, which is a staggering number. But the thing is, it isn't just that the laws suddenly were enforced, because the laws were always there, laws against drunk driving. They certainly got more, the punishments got more severe. But basically, it just, you know, became the wrong thing to do. You know, people realized, wait a minute, you need a designated driver. You need not to do that. It just, you know, it almost changed overnight. And yeah. I think we're close to that point with this one here. There's no fully rational case for preserving the status quo that you're still struggling against, you know, in your job. There just isn't, you know. So
yeah. Anyway,
other than, hey, this is where we've been doing it and there's no other way, you know. Yeah. We need the numbers. You know,
yeah. Well,
no, there have to be other ways. This is the internet. We can, you know, we have technology. We can make stuff up. We can do new things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can be done.
Yeah. You're right. I mean, we're sort of living, like we're literally like living in some sci-fi novel that we didn't even know about. Right. Like, and we willingly have given information away and we've willingly jumped on these bandwagons. And so I think what's happened after like this maybe 20 years, right, is that people are start waking up and saying, oh, you know, I don't know if I want to do that, or there must be other ways, or maybe I've beaten that dead lead gen horse to death and there aren't any more to come out of that. Because, I mean, people bought products and all, you know, for years. They didn't need somebody lead genning them to do it. So I don't know. I love data. I do. It's sort of a mixed bag because I do love data. I mean, it is fascinating, but data is just one part of any sales process. Is you can't just like hang your hat on the data, right? Like it needs the human interaction or the case studies or, you know, whatever sales engineer, like there's so many things that go into buying product besides yeah. just data point. So I feel like we've gotten so weighted on that. It is actually bizarre to me how much people weight they literally put in that data versus all the other elements that make up a company and a product and marketing and selling and all of that. And it's made our jobs, whether you're on the writing side, the you know, the website managing side, the sales side, it's just our jobs are very difficult because we're just constantly chasing after things instead of having things that actually are meaningful, that make sense. So that is my hope. Like I said, when I joined here, it's like, wow, they have a very different narrative going. I have not heard at all. I have 20 years, never heard any of this. Okay, they want that kind of lead. Oh, they want that kind of system. Okay, well, we'll find a way to do it. We'll do it. Don't worry, we'll do it. Like, there was never a no. And suddenly it's like, no, yeah. We don't do that. We don't force our readers to do that. We don't do that. And I kind of like it because I don't even think we should be. And clearly from our data, we have, you know, a million plus really, really solid readers who love us. So it's not like we've got three people reading us every week. So, you know, we have the audience. So that's really the main criteria. And you're not coming to Linux Journal to find things out if you're really not in the market, right? It's not like, I mean, I'll, you know, truthfully, most of our stuff I read, it's like, oh my gosh, I don't really know what this is. What are these words? You know, so I'm not the advertiser's looking for, but most of the people obviously coming to our site know what they're doing, and this is fascinating information that they need for their jobs, or they just love it so much.
We don't have anybody coming who's not an expert at something.
No.
Yeah, just, there they all are, you know.
They're there.
So
to me, it's what other data do you need? You know, they're there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think a good way to conclude maybe would be to tell you. We've been talking a while, but I think, you know, I think something that Dana said is that, yeah, people are coming to Linux Journal, and I think they're increasingly coming to Linux Journal. Frankly, our audience has increased substantially in the past year. I think part of the reason is because we have revised our social contract with our readers. We are treating them with respect, and they are coming back. And I think, you know, maybe we should give some advice to people out there trying to reach these really cool, smart people. And that might just be that try to, you know, being creepy isn't a good way to sell stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody be less creepy. You don't need to stalk people in order to get your message out. Just have a good conversation.
It's so true.
That's something good to say, right? What advice do you have, Doc, for our readers and our advertisers?
Well, it's a difficult question, but I just ask, what does it take to make a customer? I mean, if you're whoever you are, and I can tell you, it's not a lead alone. I mean, you got to have something that's worthwhile to people. And what is it that makes it worthwhile? What is it that's worth talking about that you make? We have people you can talk with about it. You know, they may not buy it right away, but you can talk with them about it. How do you get through to that? Well, you engage them somehow. We've got a system for engagement. It's not all of engagement, but it's part of engagement. We have interesting stuff to people that care about the issues surrounding technology that relies on Linux and open source and free software. And the world is being made by that. And we've got people who like to make the world. So do you want to engage these people? Great. We can help with that. You know, I think that's, you know, but for the people listening to this on the agency or the intermediary side, you know, also open your mind to what made advertising work in the first place. You know, what is it, you know, what made all the brands you can name?
Yeah.
You know, you needed a damn good product to begin with, if it's well known enough. But, you know, it wasn't stalking people like marked animals. It was something else. You know, so...
Do you think that to our readers also, and other people listening to this, do you think it will be effective to, let's say, raise their consumer voices a little bit and try and in whatever way they can to remind, I mean, how do they remind vendors that the way to get their attention is not through stalking, but through other means?
I don't know.
how do we engage the consumer a little bit? I don't know.
Well,
maybe that's a question for everybody.
I think part of it is making really clear what role our ads have when they see them, right? I mean, one of the things that we do with the unconference that I help put on twice a year at the Computer History Museum, we have sponsors, but the sponsors only buy food. And, you know, their names are up on a big banner by the door. But we tell them that going in, you know, they're nobody buys a speech. There's nobody speaking. There are no panels, nothing. You know, one sponsored, mostly to buy food. You know, this one's buying the bagels at breakfast. This one's buying the lunch. This one's buying the dinner out the second evening. But in some cases, it's, you know, this one is buying the projectors, you know, that we're renting, or this one's buying all of the power strips at the tables. You know, that's one of the cheaper sponsorships. And but the my point with that is there's no cognitive overhead to it. In other words, you know, people when they see the ad, they know it's not doing wrong by them. It's just there for to help out, you know, and that's part of it too. I mean, I think a sponsor of Linux Journal is also signing on to what our agenda is, mm-hmm. or what our agendas are. And some of our agendas are about Linux and open source, but it's also about ethical treatment of other people. You know, that's part of what you were saying earlier, Catherine, about why our readership is growing. You know, it's and part of it is not just an audience. You know, an audience kind of sits still and watches something. I think we have participants. We have people who are engaged, even if we don't hear from them directly. You know, they're engaged. I mean, I have one. I heard from Bob Frankston yesterday. He's one of the co-inventors of the spreadsheet. He wrote VisiCalc way long ago, and he took exception to something I wrote about 5G. He hates 5G. He thinks 5G is bullshit. And he you know, so we had a big back and forth about it. You know, that's not going to be a letter to the editor. It's just something that's part of the magazine, you know, but it was something that got him going. Right. And I probably have a dozen of those conversations based on everything I write in the magazine that are offline, but are part of the dialogue, you know, and I didn't tell him to read Linux Journal. He just read it. You know, he just, hey, wait a minute. This is something I care about. This is something I want to do. I told him, hey, look, write a piece, you know, and he joked that, you know, my telling him what to do is like one ADHD case trying to tell another ADHD case what to do. So it's unlikely to happen, but still it's that engagement, right? It's all about the engagement. Yeah.
That's sort of interesting, though. I kind of like that idea of almost, I don't know if we could or if it would work, but almost highlighting or sort of bringing some of these readers to life just because they really are Linux Journal, right? All of these really high-end, really bright men and women that are running the world, right? And just who they are, what they work on, even if they want to just be anonymous. But I think sometimes, I think that's what's sort of gotten lost in this digital age is that who the readers are. And not just in numbers. Oh, they buy this or this is their stat, right? But like real living, breathing people, they work at XYZ company and this is what they do and this is their challenges and they read to Linux Journal to find out or they read this story and it really helped them or they attended this webinar, right? Like really bringing them maybe a little bit more to life because I feel like not us, but sort of marketing has made the reader sort of just almost a flat non-person, just a data point versus No, you sit up. I'm not a lead. Here I am. This is what I do, right? Because it makes it, that's just like, it goes back to my point where I like meeting with people because when you meet with people, it's so much more real. This is much more real than an email or phone. And so we have so many readers, it wouldn't even maybe be hard to bring them, some of them to life more. But I think that's gotten lost, not because of us, but in the shuffle of the last decade of just real living, breathing people that really, really do high-end work. And you don't really think about it because you're just trying to find a lead to get in your funnel to get in some journey, but these are real.
The funnel and the journey.
The journey off the edge of the earth.
I didn't know I was on a journey.
What the hell is this journey?
I think this is the perfect note to conclude on.
Bring up the music.
Keep me out of your funnel.
Keep me out of your funnel.
Yeah.
That may be a title for it.
I want to thank you both just because I love your podcasts so much. I love them. They're so well done. And I am truly honored and just so appreciative of getting to be on one with you. So I really
thanks.
Want
to. Well, we appreciate it.
It's like a little peek behind the curtain.
Thank you.
You might be the wizard.
Yeah.
I'm so thrilled. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you too.